For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
So you know, we're in the middle of this practice commitment period, I think about week six, and I hope everybody's doing okay. It's kind of nice to get this warm weather to energize us, and even better that this warm weather welcomes our Tonto, Douglas Floyd, Dragon Extraordinaire. So, you know, a Tonto, just for those who don't speak that Zen language, is kind of the master of ceremonies. And, you know, Usazen itself is a ceremony. So everything you do in the Sendo is usually a ceremony. So Douglas is the master of ceremonies. Aishin is also a Tonto Aishin, but she's not speaking in the Dharma Talk today. They're sharing that seat, which helps everything run smoothly in the meditation hall, but also really being available for questions and conversation about practice. So without further ado, you know, so much can be said, but I'll let Douglas speak for himself. Thank you, Douglas. Sure. Why not? Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Can you put it a little closer? I got a... All right, let's do a sankhya. Could you talk a little more?
I could talk a lot more.
We've got thumbs ups.
Okay, good. All right, good evening. It's unfortunate that Ogetsu mentioned that I'm supposed to keep things running smoothly because I came last night, pulled out my notes, and realized that half of them are missing, so I don't know how smoothly this will go. So tonight's talk was advertised on the website as a Tonto talk. And other than the fact that the Tonto is giving it, I'm not sure what makes it a Tonto talk, but I can throw in some Tonto stuff real quick. You know, the forms that we practice in the Zendo are ways in which we express our appreciation and the realization of ignorance. And just doing it, not only is it a matter of just content, showing the respect, but following these admittedly pretty arbitrary rules require us to step outside of our distracted mind to be right here in our surroundings and so to wake up to the mind. So I just wanted to talk about a few forms related to standing and moving in the Zendo. I think everyone is pretty clear that when you walk into the Zendo, you step in with your left foot, one step, two steps, and then bow to the Zendo in Gashen. And then you hold your hands in Shashu by wrapping your left hand's fingers around your thumb and covering your left hand with your right hand with the thumb on top of them. That's the default position anytime you're walking or standing in the Zendo. When you walk to your seat for Zazen, when you reach it, you turn to face, and you bow first toward your cushion, Gashen, and then you turn and face the room and bow Gashen to the other side of the room and then turn clockwise and sit down facing the wall. So first the bow to the cushion and then bow to the room. There are a couple of refinements. So when you're sitting at your seat for Zazen and someone else comes on either side of you to take a seat and they bow to their cushion, then you return the bow. Our forms are not as fancy as Japanese forms or even San Francisco Zen Center, but there's a little refinement. So, for example, jhana were to come and bow toward her cushion, then even though there's an empty space, that would return back. And if Matt were facing the middle of the room and Jonathan came to his feet, bowed toward his cushion, and then bowed toward the middle of the room, then Matt's sitting directly across the center from him would return the bow on behalf of that side of the center. And we can go home. In choosing a topic for tonight, I was just struck when I was reading by the Browsing Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, the now pre-war Bible of the Sandhas within the Sushumna Samhita translation. I look at the prologue, Beginner's Mind, which the book is named Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, and saw the statement that, what is it? Beginner's Mind. Beginner's mind is the mind of compassion. And that sort of struck some sparks with me. Okay, I'm going to have to spend some more time on that, especially since the topic of our practice today is compassion's way. And I was particularly interested because this is in the preface titled Beginner's Mind. And we've been reading and watching videos of Blanche Hartman. And Beginner's Mind is a theme that's very important to Blanche. In her book, Seeds for a Boundless Life, she has at least two Dharma talks that are addressed to Beginner's Mind. And so there were some other questions you could have. Okay, what does he mean by that? But, you know, about Beginner's Mind. In the expression, a perfect expression of compassion, is, you know, how does that work? Why beginner's mind? How is beginner's mind this expression of compassion? And how do these fit in with the really the most famous quotation from this preface? Is that in the beginner's mind there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are a few. So, okay, who are the experts? And why does the expert have fewer choices, possibilities, and the beginner has many possibilities? It's sort of the opposite. You know, obviously, Suzuki Roshi's Zen teacher loves those contradictions. It seems it runs counter to our experience anyway. Everybody here has had a job, they become very good at the job. People who are good at the job, they have lots of possibilities for the way they can do things and do them better than a beginner who just walks in and knows nothing. So what are we talking about?
Douglas, I'm sorry to interrupt. Speaking of jobs, as techno, would you mind just like holding the mic right to your mouth? People are having trouble online hearing. I think...
Okay. Is this any better?
Keep talking.
Yes.
I mean, just the name? Is it the microphone array that is the input source?
Yeah, so that's a good question. No, we want that one.
That.
Now let's
okay, how's that?
Any better? Gate, gate.
Oh,
gate.
Got thumbs up.
Lots
there
of thumbs
go.
Up for that.
Okay.
That was
okay.
Incorrect.
Eagle has landed.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me try fastening it to the rakusu, then that would be a little more convenient.
Yeah, so it should be probably will be okay.
Still good?
Still thumbs up.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
That's,
thank you.
That's excellent. So I'm going to take a break.
Yeah.
this was right on this roll with beginners.
Yeah, yeah, forget it. I could be a prima donna if I want to. So, you know, I think something to understand about Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and Zen texts generally is that you're not explaining to you how to do something. They're talking about what you do, what the significance of that is. And that's the case in the Beginner's Mind preface as much as in the rest of the book. What's, in order to understand the references to Beginner's Mind and the Expert's Mind, I think it's important to recognize that these are sort of elaborations of a theme that appears throughout Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, the difference between a small mind and big mind. Big mind is frequently called original mind or boundless mind or Buddha mind. Small mind, he also often calls limited mind. And small mind is the mind we have so much of the time when we're trying to achieve something or feeling some sort of craving, some desire or strong emotion about something. Really, small mind is the mind that we have when we're trying to ensure our, in trying to deal with our vulnerability. So we're trying to ensure our security and our comfort and the approval of others, maybe even our own approval. We're trying to make something happen, not just on the cushion, but in our life. And when we do that, when we get caught up in the whole construction, we are committed to thinking, we're committed to feeling and desire. I want that. I don't want this. I'm thinking about that. I think this is better than that. In your Zazen, you've noticed the difference between that kind of experience, that where you were engaged in thinking, and the experience that thoughts and emotions and desires are arising and falling away. The difference between I'm thinking and thoughts are arising and falling away. And that's the difference between what's going on with small mind, limited mind, and big mind. In small mind, limited mind, when we start doing that, the mind becomes immersed in the thinking and the feeling and focused, grasps, becomes attached to that activity of thinking or feeling or desiring and the object of thinking or desiring and emotion. And so it's smaller. Suzuki Roshi calls it then a limited mind because that's what it's focused on. It's completely occupied, pretty much occupied by that. The rest is back there, you're aware of it, but it's in the background. And Suzuki Roshi frequently calls that your small self, your limited self. And that's in contrast to big mind, which is complete in itself. It isn't reaching out for anything. It's there, thoughts, emotions, desires, judgments are coming and going, you're responding, but you're not trying to make things happen. You know, the distinction between responding to things without clinging and attachment and desire and the small mind, which is really into fix, manage, and control completely. It's always me dealing with that, making it better or keeping it from becoming bad. So big mind, Suzuki Roshi will say, okay, big mind is boundless. It's complete. It's the mind in which we recognize that our life is a part of this situation, of this world. In effect, the whole world and with us in it becomes our greater life. And he calls that experience the experience of big I sometimes. Our practice is about opening up that small mind and realizing, coming back to the experience of big mind. we sit here, not really doing anything, letting our minds whirl and whirl and whirl and whirl, and as it does, we don't interfere with them, the thoughts, we let them go. We're not attached to them, and they slow down, and as they slow down, we open up to this big mind. And as we let the thoughts and emotions and desires come up and go and come up and go, they discharge their habit energy so they have less effect on us. They snatch us up less than they did before, and we are able to be aware within our big mind, in that big self, of those thoughts, emotions, desires, and judgments coming and going and coming and going. That's what Suzuki Roshi is trying to play with a little bit when he talks about beginner's mind and the expert's mind. Because the expert is, we're all experts. When we come to circumstances and we bring with us and try to react to circumstances out of this store of know-how and knowledge and information that we have in the past, all this stuff, this karma that exists and is there to respond to events, karma that's either innate or that is learned through just through life, through living, and through experience. So, the expert, an expert always comes to a situation, and every situation is a problem that needs to be fixed. And the expert brings a whole toolbox to that situation, saying, okay, does this situation meet the following material facts? If so, I have a script that tells me how to resolve that problem, how to act. That's not really an encounter. That's not really being there with the situation. You know, big mind is always there. It's what, you know, Keizan, who was Dogen's Dharma great-grandson, you know, in the first case of his collected koans, enlightenment stories of the Buddhas and ancestors, talked about Shakyamuni Buddha's awakening on the eighth day of the 12th month, saying that, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha saw the morning star and attained Buddhahood, and the first thing he said was, now I, together with the great earth and all beings, simultaneously realize the way. That together with, intimately, together, connected, inseparable, not one essence, but completely inseparable and indivisible, is the experience of awakening to big mind. And that's how Keizan talks about it. The experience of the expert's mind who comes to this situation, it's out there. There's something, it's out there, but the expert's not really paying attention to it. And just it's just running through the changes. It's always, I'm going to fix this. I'm going to correct this. I can do this. The beginner's mind, and Suzuki Roshi makes it clear that he's comparing it, he's making it the equivalent of big mind, because he talks about it as our boundless original mind as well. So why beginner's mind? And I think there are a couple of reasons for it. One is he inherited the term from Dogen. It's an important term for Dogen, who likes to insist that the zazen of a beginner is the manifestation of complete, perfect awakening. just like the awakening of an expert, a seasoned long-term practitioner. So Suzuki Roshi wants to make that point. But he also wants to make the point that in beginner's mind, we respond to a situation by coming to it without attempting to fix it, to control it, to have some sort of achievement. We're not trying to gain anything. We are responding to this situation, expressing this situation, not trying to control it. Just as if we didn't have our own store of information and experience and know-how that we could bring to this situation. We will have those, but we are approaching the situation first by finding ourselves together with our surroundings, with the entire world. And then we bring our knowledge and our know-how without clinging. But we do cling, right? So we'll respond, and there'll be delusion as we respond to something in particular. And that's where beginner comes as well, because we wake up again to a new life. Suzuki Roshi says that in big mind, we continually die to our small self. A small mind. So I think that Suzuki Roshi is aiming at that too, just trying to call out the freshness of big mind, that we find ourselves as a part of our surroundings in every moment as something new, something to respond to. Without having the reaction of trying to defend ourselves or protect ourselves or to ensure our security or our comfort or the approval of others. So, finding ourselves in beginner's mind and in big mind, finding ourselves always part of our surroundings is also an experience of intimate connection and warmth. We aren't feeling the need to control. We're not feeling that we're being controlled. We are opening to this situation. And that's why Dogen Zenji would talk about how that's how compassion arises. And he emphasizes in this preface, the way he does across the entire book, that in responding from that intimate sense of connection, we respond to our big self naturally, in a way that conforms to the precepts. We keep the precepts without following rules, because we are acting out of kindness and generosity and compassion, out of that sense of connection to everything, which Dogen calls identity action. It's myself meeting myself, or bigger self meeting bigger self. That is, in Suzuki Roshi, that is Suzuki Roshi's entire approach to the precepts. That when we violate the precepts, it's because we have fallen into small mind, limited mind. We're gaining mind, grasping, trying to achieve something. And that by acting out of big mind and acting as a part of our situation, we will naturally keep the precepts without following rules. So, thank you for this opportunity to sit tonight so that we could realize big mind together. I am happy to respond to any comments, questions, objections. Thank you very much. If I don't see anyone on the screen raising their hand, would you let me know?
I will.
Poke me.
I want to check in. How many people have read or even read a quote from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind? Almost everyone. And if you haven't, don't feel left out, but this book, you know, is sort of our major text in our school of Zen. So, you know, I think it's good to think, how do you understand big mind, you know, and small mind? And where do you notice that come up? Or if you don't know what Douglas is talking about, ask him more questions.
Well, I'll talk about it some more. Yeah. I think it's something that everyone in this room has experienced from the very first time you sat on a cushion, right? Where your mind went wild and you just became overwhelmed and immersed in your thinking. And then you went, okay, here I am. Here I am. That is the direct experience of the difference between big mind and small mind. Beginner's mind and expert's mind. We experience that from the first time we sit on the cushion. And as we practice and our mind settles more and more and more, it becomes more familiar. And we try to express that then in our daily lives. But it's not something exotic or something that you haven't experienced before. It's part of who we are. That mind is always there. Even if we don't see it, there's nothing in the content, we'll call it the content of big mind that all isn't also in small mind. It's just that we're distracted. Our attention gets caught up in attachment, aversion, and our confusion. But the big mind is always there. And so if we have a gap, or if our small mind quiets down, that experience of big mind being part of our surroundings is there. It's not something created. Lou.
Thank you for the talk. Do you have any? I mean, I'm thinking about an experience of like being swept up in emotion and thinking during that emotion, boy, I wish I were in big mind now. Like, I feel this small mind just. Small mind feels real big right now, and it's not the bigness I want. It feels like big mind sometimes is very far away, even when I'm aware it exists, and I really wish it were more at hand, but it feels very distant, and it might take minutes or hours or even days before I can look back at that experience and think with more equanimity or compassion for myself, here's where the big mind is. finally got here. Do you have any thoughts? I assume this is kind of a familiar experience for people. Do you have any thoughts about that and how to grow the accessibility, let's say, of big mind?
Yes. Well, first, I would invite you to consider that not just being caught up in the suffering of memories or fantasies or daydreams, but recognizing that you've been feeling, that you are feeling this and you have been, that is in itself big mind. Doesn't mean that big mind feels good. And Zen practice is challenging. And it's not because it's hard to figure out, and not necessarily because keeping our legs crossed and our back straight for a long time is painful, although that certainly can be true. But just sitting there and being willing to sit with painful memories and emotions and fears and anger, it's hard and it takes courage. But doing it, I can only speak from personal experience that really hard experiences, you know, you sit with them and over time you, I hate the word, process them. And it becomes easier and they may even disappear. But that's an experience that every person who's practiced for any real length of time is going to have, but that being with them and letting the emotions come and then subside is something that's not going to go on forever. That feeling. So thank you for continuing to practice in spite of that painful emotion. Hard to do.
Thank you. I feel like I'm continually needing reminders that there's not a switch, there's not a magic wand, and make it easy. And that hanging in there with the hardness, the difficulty of the practice is very helpful. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. Although I also want to make a warning, although I don't want to be a downer, that you can sit with some very painful experience and gradually find yourself being able to face it and be with it, and it gets less and less painful and grabbing your attention less and less so that you're able to sit with it, and finally it's just not bothering you anymore. But you don't know. That it may be that sometime in the future there will be the right event, triggering event, that will revive it, and you'll have to do it again. But by going through that experience, recognizing it, it doesn't have the same control over you. You're not dragged around by it as much. So just the fact of recognizing it in itself somehow mitigates the force, maybe mitigates the pain, but it also is an experience of freedom, just recognizing it and not being dragged around, pushed around by the emotion, being able to act from that awareness.
Great, thank you.
Thanks.
Eve has also raised her hand online.
There you are in the corner.
Yeah, well, what resonated for me was when you talked about letting go of control. And I feel that, you know, when you desperately want things to be different, either for yourself or for the world, that you want to, to do things and have a desired outcome. And I think, you know, from what you said, from the vantage point of Big Mind, we can still take right action and we can still discern what's the right action, but we have to let go of controlling the outcome. I mean, we take a right action because we think it'll achieve a desired outcome, or we just feel, you know, this is the right action. This is what I can do. But letting go of, you know, the feeling that like you're in the wrong if you do something and it doesn't turn out the way you want it to. Yes, I wanted to know what you thought.
Well, I think you're right. We can't control the outcomes. What we can do is recognize and respond to the suffering of the world. Responding out of that awareness of compassion and being with and kindness, recognizing that we're not going to, I would say, trying to respond to suffering in this moment, doing what you can. And don't focus so much on outcomes and solutions. There's a, you know, respond, act out of kindness and compassion in the direction you would like to go in this moment, but recognize that you don't have control over that.
Oh, the outcome, yeah. And I have one more question. I mean, when you were saying, when you're sitting on the cushion and you're saying, here I am. So the Hebrew phrase for that is hineni. Leonard Cohen used that in his last album. And hineni has the meaning also of I'm ready. So it's here I am, I'm ready to serve. So I just wondered if, you know, in your view, that's part of the here I am.
Yeah, I think that even if you're sitting on your cushion, you need to be prepared to respond to the moment if something arises. It would be bad practice to sit and watch someone who's hurt themselves hurt without taking any action. So yes, there is a reason, you know, our practice is, it is a response to the world, recognizing that we are part of our surroundings, that our life is part of our surroundings.
And that's part of being mind, right? Recognizing that you're part of this larger whole.
Yeah, I think, you know, but without saying, oh, this is big mind or, oh, this is an experience of wholeness or something like that. It is that experience.
It is, yeah.
Of being here in the surroundings.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
I don't know which end is that, but thank you for the talk. I was, as part of the PCP with the outline for the week, on the way here, I was listening to Darlene Cohen's talk that's linked on her own experiences of sort of riding the waves of sexuality and being a sexual being. And I felt like it resonated so deeply with, I'm one of those, I picked up Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind 20 years ago and was like, oh, this is completely vapid. And then Tigan was like, well, maybe now you should pick it up again. And now I find all sorts of gems in it. But I hadn't yet gotten to this part of this idea of violating the precepts as sort of a fall into small mind. And it felt so parallel to Darlene's message and that idea of focusing less on sort of the rules and more on sort of the breaks or when we're sinking into that just felt really powerful. So thank you for highlighting that.
Yeah, I think that will be a big part of our discussions of Darlene Cohen, right?
Yeah.
She has such an awareness of how self-centered, selfish sexuality can be really destructive, and an awareness of responsibility in sexual relationships is very important. I'm sure that she has raised
or did raise plenty of eyebrows in the past.
She sounds like it.
Trying to live out the precepts in that way. And so it'll be an interesting discussion.
Thank you so much for your talk. I was interested in when you talked for a moment about karma, and karma came up in this as well. And I liked what you said about learned karma. You said I'd never heard that before, but I guess, I don't know. I was wondering what, I mean, karma as kind of a response to something. I didn't exactly know. What you meant.
Well, you know, karma is just the conditioning that exists in our mind under the surface. And it could be, at least we talk about it in 21st century America, is including things like genetics, other things, and other biological aspects of conditioning how we respond, experience and respond to situations. But karma is generally, you know, all of our experience that we have is stored in our mind, and all of our actions, body, speech, or mind, our intentional actions, try to avoid jargon language, but plant a seed subconsciously that can then, when we meet the right causes and conditions, the right circumstances, flower into action in response to that, to those causes, to a situation, causes and conditions. You know, you can think of karma as when we act, when we speak, when we think, we leave a trace of conditioning and a greater propensity to act in a similar way under what we perceive as similar circumstances. And those karmic seeds remain in place until they're expressed. They could be expressed in activity, in which case, if you do the same thing again, you'll plant another seed in your consciousness. But if in Zazen, for example, if thoughts come up, desires come up, and you're aware of them and don't act on them, they discharge their energy and their gone, or at least weakened.
How do you think karma and karmic consciousness relates to bigot small mind? That's a big question, but it's sort of a follow-up, maybe piggybacking off of you, Noah.
You know, small mind is... I think small mind is, to a large extent, it's just the playing out of our karmic conditioning faced with circumstances. But small mind exists within big mind. I mean, we can have all these feelings and desires and so on, but be completely aware of them and not act on them. I think that is part of what we're doing, what our practice is learning to be aware of our reactivity, but not let it take control. Not let it express itself in a harmful way. You must have some thoughts.
Well, I don't know. I'm curious about your thoughts. I'm about karma. Remember the story with Darlene, though?
No, which one?
The one where she's like, I don't believe in karma and all that crap. There's a... you remember. Sorry. So in the book, The Hidden Lamp, there is a story of the last commentary
is Leslie James, who's a San Francisco Zen Center person, commenting on something that was observed with Darlene as she was dying. And Darlene said something like, I don't believe in karma and all that crap. And her students said like something, you know, well, what do you believe in? You know, yeah. Or what do you do? And she's basically like, you know,
Something about a lie through it or something about lying.
Yeah, you know, I'd lie even if, you know, like I'd create bad karma, you could say, if it were helpful to someone. You know, and so anyway, yeah, we could look at that later, but I was just, yeah. You know, that was the first thing that popped up when you asked me the question, Douglas, but I don't know anything about karma.
Well, maybe, you know,
Darlene
I don't
believe in it, but I just don't know anything about it.
To the extent that I don't believe in karma in the most popular sense that there is a moral force that responds to my actions so that the universe makes sure that some sort of poetic justice occurs. as a psychological phenomenon, I doubt very much that Darlene Cohen did not believe in karma. Having lived as long as she did, the way she did, there were patterns of behavior. She went through a lot of stuff, repeating the same kind of behavior. I think she would have recognized that she was conditioned by her past. So karma in that sense, I don't think is controversial. Karma as something that might carry over to a new life, a rebirth, you know, that's something you're all going to have to decide about yourselves.
I think David Wright had a thought. Great.
That's David. Yeah, the guy who's done a lot of reading in the last year on karma.
I haven't read anywhere near the stuff that you recommended me to read, Douglas. You gave me a reading list, and I have not made that much progress on it. I just want to say I'm kind of getting into Darlene Cohen, so I was really struck by that teaching story as well, where she says, I don't believe in karma, I just believe in skillful means, which means I'm willing to lie about anything. I guess that means she says, what I believe in is compassion. But it struck me that in the sexuality talk at a certain moment, this really struck me. She says, and she's talking about Thich Nhat Hanh and how she's just not down with the version of the precepts, the precept against, you know, misuse of sexuality. I talked about this last time. But what she says at that moment, she says, maybe my sexual karma is just really different from Thich Nhat Hanh's. And I thought that was interesting because, like, at that moment, she finds the word karma useful. She finds it skillful, and I really feel that as helpful too. I just wanted to throw that out there because, as I said, I'm getting into Darlene. I really like that.
Well, and I think that, you know, it's going to get in the weeds, but I think that, you know, different cultures' understandings of sexuality and what is and isn't appropriate sexuality and what might be harmful or not harmful, they're different. And so I would expect them, you know, to have different psychological consequences and conditioning on the future activity and experience of the person who's engaged in sexual relations, you know? There are cultures where homosexuality has been a pretty big deal, and people who were homosexual and engaged in homosexual acts could have a great deal of suffering that carried forward and affected their lives in the future. All of that would be karma. There are other societies where it's not a big deal. It may not even a word for homosexual. And so there wouldn't be the same consequences for people of having sex with someone of the same sex. So it's not, you know, it's not something like there, you could write formulas of always, you, this happens and then this karma will flower down the road. It's all, and there's never, never going to be a one-to-one correspondence between an intentional act and the consequence that you feel. There's causes and conditions, you know, they're infinite, you know. There's always causation, but identifying the specific causality, you can't. Anyway.
Well,
we're done?
Maybe this is a good time for us to move along, and I know David Weiner needs to go. Maybe I could borrow your microphone.
Mike?
Just for a second.
No, you can keep it. It's yours.
Okay, sure. I just want to thank everybody, and thank you very much, Douglas, and everyone, really. This kind of, you know, I didn't expect karma to come up around big mind or little mind, but somehow it did, and I want to think more about it and feel more about it and get into it a little, because I think David Ray pointing out this thing about Darlene, very generous comment too, to really acknowledge the variegation of people on this dimension of sexuality, and kind of be like, you know, we have to own who we are. And I think in her talk she does that very nicely, but I just want to thank you, Douglas, and of course we'll hear more from Douglas. And did we want to do some vows and then announcements? How would that work?
Mm-hmm. Shall I end recording?
That probably is a good idea.
All right.
Thank you, Lou.